We're looking at the second of the two major books that Taya wrote, The Divine Media, which is more specifically a Christian theology. And we had noted that he had three special grievances against the popular understanding of Christian faith, both by its enemies and by some who are within the Christian community. First of all, the depreciation of the human and the world. Secondly, the inhumanity of certain forms of Christian faith that restrict the creative achievements of man as man. And thirdly, resignation in the presence of evil. Teilhard's purpose is to write a book to help men see God everywhere, to see him in what is most hidden, most solid, and most ultimate in the world. And then we had begun on his positive statement. First of all, the divinization, or as we would say in the terminology of our own tradition more, the sanctification of our activities. Here he rejects the notion that the world is a trial ground for the soul and insists on the positive nature of man's human work. We noted also his attitude toward creation. But Teilhard speaks not simply of the divinization of our activities, but also the divinization of the sanctification of what he calls our passivities. Our passivities are the things that are undergone by us rather than things that are done by us. And as such, they're far more numerous, while our activities press more upon our conscious thought. We think more about our activities. Actually, the passivities of life, according to Teilhard, immeasurably the wider and the deeper part of life. In fact, we only know a small part of conscious existence, and as we look within the depths of our own personal existence, we lose ourselves. Yet the passivities are beyond our conscious awareness. The forces that sustain us and play upon us are beyond our calculation. But there are also the passivities of diminishment. It is easy enough for us to understand how God can be grasped in and through every life through the passivities that sustain us. But can God be known in the passivities that diminish life, the passivities that appear to be destructive? Can also God be found in every death? The forces of diminishment, Teilhard says, are the real passivities. Their number is vast, their forms infinitely varied, their influence constant. The diminishments of life are more than the loss of a few things that we can later get back. Incidentally, there's no universalism in Teilhard. Whatever his heresies may be, universalism is not one of them. Strangely enough, in spite of his optimism. In a sense, the loss of things means little to us, many things, because we can always imagine we can get them back. But there's some things we cannot get back. And what is terrible for us is to be cut off from things through some inward diminishment that can never be retrieved. Death comes as a sum and the consummation of these diminishments. Can we divinize, sanctify our passivities? Well, Teilhard is convinced that we can. One aspect of the divinization of our passivities is our struggle with God against evil. When a Christian says, for example, God has touched me when he suffers, the words are preeminently true, Teilhard says, but their simplicity summarizes a very complex series of operations. It is not simply true that God has touched us, unless we are willing to put together a good many affirmations. And it is only when we have gone through all the operations or series of operations that we have the right to speak the word, God has touched me, when we suffer. This problem of evil is very difficult, in part because our lives are so short that we cannot hope to know in human history the joy of full victory. Therefore, Teilhard relates evil in particular to the ongoing organization of the world. About this I'll say a little bit more later. It has to be seen in the perspective of the organization of the world. As he writes, to quote, "In virtue of his very perfections, God cannot ordain that the elements of a world in the course of growth, or at least of a fallen world in the process of rising again, should avoid shocks and diminishments, even moral ones. But God will make it good. He will take his revenge, if one may use the expression, by making evil itself serve a higher good of his faithful. The very evil which the present state of creation does not allow him to suppress immediately. Like an artist who is able to make use of a fault or an impurity in the stone he is sculpting or the bronze he is casting so as to produce a more exquisite lines or a more beautiful tone, God, without sparing us the partial deaths nor the final death, which form an essential part of our lives, transfigures them by integrating them in a better plan, provided we lovingly trust him. Not only our unavoidable ills, but our faults, even our most deliberate ones, can be embraced in that transformation, provided we always repent of them. Not everything is immediately good to those who seek God, but everything is capable of becoming good." Therefore, suffering can be fitted into this evolutionary development of the world with some loss, but nevertheless with faithfulness fitted into. Yet Teilhard is insistent that we have the right to speak of evil or of suffering as the touch of God only when it is not due to our negligence or fault, and only when all of our strength has been spent. This is the counterpart of Bonhoeffer's Chief Grace. Had no right to talk about forgiveness until we've done everything we can to obey the law. We have no right to talk about the touch of God in evil until we've done everything we can to overcome evil, not a supine resignation in the presence of evil. Now, the third part of the divine meteor deals with the divine meteor itself. The first two parts of the divine meteor, Teilhard regarded as commentaries upon Paul's words that through our life and through our death, in our life and in our death, we belong to Christ. We have considered, Teilhard says, in turn, the sphere of activity, development in life, the sphere of passivity, diminishment and death in our lives. All around us, to the right and left, in front and behind, above and below, we have only had to go a little beyond the frontier of sensible appearance in order to discover the divine well enough and showing through. The divine meteor is as vast as the world and more formidable than the immense energies of the world. Yet it possesses in a supreme degree that precise, concentrated particularity which makes up so much of the warm charm of human persons. God reveals himself everywhere beneath our groping efforts as a universal meteor, only because he is the ultimate point upon which all reality is converged. Teilhard makes two important observations concerning the manner in which the divine is apprehended. In the first place, the manifestation of the divine no more modifies the apparent order of things than the Eucharistic consecration modifies a sacred species to our eyes. That is to say, religious experience is not a discrete, desperate, separate, unique experience that can be set apart from the world. Rather, the experience of the divine presence is a quality of our experience of things. A quotation I gave yesterday, "God waits for us in things," is one of Teilhard's great words. In the second place, the perception of the divine omnipresence is essentially a seeing, a taste. That is to say, a sort of intuition bearing upon certain superior qualities in things. It cannot, therefore, be attained directly by any process of reasoning or by any human artifice. It is like a gift, like life itself, of which it is undoubtedly the supreme example. Now, this divine presence waits for us in all things is focused in Christ. Teilhard speaks of the universal Christ, and he interprets Christ in a cosmic sense. The divine powers that are everywhere working in the world are concentrated in him and radiate out from him, not only to men, but throughout all creation. Teilhard closely relates the incarnation as a historical event to the general development of the world. In fact, from the beginning of the messianic preparation up until the parousia, passing through the historic manifestation of Jesus and the phases of growth of his church, a single event has been developing in the world, the incarnation, realized in each individual through the Eucharist. All the communions of a lifetime are one communion. All the communions of men now living are one communion. All the communions of all men, present, past, and future, are one communion. Or again, Teilhard writes, Christ, for whom and in whom we are formed, each with his own individuality and his vocation, Christ reveals himself in each reality around us, shines like an ultimate determinant, like a center. One might almost say like a universal element. As our humanity assimilates the material world, as the host, that with capital H, as the host assimilates our humanity, the Eucharistic transformation goes beyond and completes the transubstantiation of the bread on the altar. Step by step, it irresistibly invades the universe. It is the fire that sweeps over the hearth, the stroke that vibrates the bronze. In a secondary and generalized sense, but in a true sense, the sacramental species are formed by the totality of the world, and the duration of creation is the time needed for its consecration. The sanctification of the life of the life as individual, as one participates in the life of Christ, but it's also communal. The divine media is intensified, our awareness of the divine media is intensified through charity. And here again, as in the phenomenon of man, Teilhard looks forward to the unification of all things in Christ. The divine media will ultimately be one in the Pleroma, must begin to become one during the earthly phase of our existence, so that although the Christian who hungers to live in God may attain all possible purity of desire, faith in prayer, fidelity in action, the divinization of the universe is still open to vast possibilities. It will still remain for him to link his elemental work to that of all laborers who surround him. The innumerable partial worlds which envelop the diverse human monads press in upon him from all around. His task is to rekindle his own order by contact with the order of all these foci, to make his own sap communicate with that circulating in the other cells, to receive or propagate movement and life for the common benefit, and to adapt himself to the common temperature and tension. While Teilhard looks forward to the fulfillment of the divine purposes in history, he also points to a grand climax when the presence of Christ, which has been silently accruing in things, will suddenly be revealed, like the flash of a light from pole to pole. Now, he doesn't mean this exactly as he says it. The end of the world will not be so much the destruction of the world in some kind of cataclysmic catastrophe, as it will be a transformation, as it will be the movement of the thinking community, the human community, into a new form of existence that is no longer limited by space and by time. Teilhard is optimistic, and he speaks against the pessimism that has been encouraged by an exaggerated conception of original sin. On original sin, I'll have a few remarks later. And which has regarded the world as decidedly and incorrigibly wicked. And nevertheless, in the divine media, Teilhard is not a universalist. And he's not a universalist anywhere, for that matter. He accepts the fact that the love of Christ may be judgment, and that Christ is also the one who separates and judges. And yet, in a very moving meditation, Teilhard speaks of hell in this way. You have told me, O God, to believe in hell. But you have forbidden me to hold absolute certainty that any single man has been damned. I shall, therefore, make no attempt to consider the damned here, nor even to discover by whatsoever means whether there are any. I shall accept the existence of hell on your word as a structural element in the universe, and I shall pray and meditate until that awe-inspiring thing appears to me as a strengthening and even blessed complement to the vision of your omnipresence which you have opened to me. Now, what shall we make of Teilhard's theology that as I have given it, and I do not claim to have done it exhaustively, and I do not claim in any sense to be an authority on Teilhard. I think what I have given is a fairly faithful statement, particularly of his theology, is to be found particularly in his two major books, The Phenomenon of Man, written in 1940, The Divine Media, written in 1927. How shall we evaluate it? What shall we do with it? This is queer theology. I do not know the backgrounds of most of you here. But for those of us who were reared and trained in the Presbyterian tradition, this is a strange way of doing theology. And you really cannot analyze it in terms of the traditional categories. When Professor Crespi of the French Reformed Church deals with Teilhard, he tries to deal with him in terms of the traditional way of doing theology in the Reformed Church, or for that matter in Roman Catholic Church, and he really can't make it fit because Teilhard just doesn't go about the task of being a theologian this way. When the men in Rome or in the Jesuit order looked at his theology, they couldn't make it fit in the traditional categories of Thomistic scholastic theology. He just doesn't do it this way, as you obvious from reading it. Well, how shall we look at it? Well, I think, first of all, we have to say here is a tremendous synoptic, perspectival vision of reality written by a man or emerging out of the life of a man who, in a very real sense, synthesizes in his own existence a life in science and life in the Christian faith. He puts together his work as a scientist with this very profound, mystic, and I would insist Christian vision of the nature of reality. So here you have what Professor Martin would call a synoptic vision of a very compelling sort, particularly for modern college students who read Teilhard a great deal. You can read Teilhard in many different ways. You can attempt to read him as a scientist. And Teilhard lays himself open to this in The Phenomenon of Man when he says this is supposed to be read as a science. But if you read Teilhard simply as a science, then this becomes nonsense. He uses scientific terms in nonsense and theological ways. Well, this, of course, grates some nerves of a scientist a great deal. He does not define his terms very clearly. They're very fuzzy. He does not sufficiently distinguish between a scientific statement and a metaphysical statement. They're all confused. And the result is that a biologist like Medawar in England can say this is phony, this is fraudulent. But on the other hand, some of the greatest biologists of our time, greatest scientists of our time, have been impressed by this book. For example, Julian Huxley, who was a friend of Teilhard, mentioned the other day at UNESCO. Waddington, the British scientist, and in particular Theodore Dobzhansky, Dobzhansky, I believe, at Rockefeller University, who is generally regarded by American biologists as kind of the apex. Dobzhansky says that Teilhard gives us some hope, and that he was greatly moved by his book. I think Ian Barbour is right when he says there is nothing in the phenomenon of man that contradicts science. But Barbour would insist you cannot read the phenomenon of man as a scientific work because it is too infused by metaphysical and philosophical ideas. Another possibility is to read it as poetry. And some have said this is what it is. It's not science, it's poetry. So we read it as poetry. Well, there's too much science in it to be read as poetry. And it's too, in a sense, there's too much theology in it to be read as poetry. But it does have a poetic quality. A third possibility is to read it as a natural theology. In the traditional Roman Catholic point of view, and Henri de Lubac, one of the great Thomists, contemporary theologians who combines Thomism with existentialism, and who has been friendly with Teilhard, suggests that this is the way you ought to read the book. I do not think this is right. I suppose you could say that this is a redressing up of the old argument from design, but if it is that, it's not too good. Because the directionality, the movement in the evolutionary process is surely an intuition of faith, and it is not simply obvious to any man that this is taking place or that it has an end. As a matter of fact, Teilhard specifically says this is the problem the evolutionist has, the anxiety about how it's all going to come out in the end. In his death, on the death of the human species on the face of this earth. It does not seem to me, if it is to be read as natural theology, then it's not too good. But it does not seem to me, whatever may have been Teilhard's intention, that this is what he actually does. He may have intended to write a natural theology, I can't say about that. But if he did intend to, he did not execute this purpose with very great skill. Because it's very clear that this is not a movement from science to faith. It's very clear from the very beginning that Teilhard's faith, his faith perspective, the faith factor in his understanding pervades and shapes his theology right from the beginning. So this is clearly... I suppose that could be said maybe in all cases of natural theology, but that reveals somewhat of my own theological bias. But in any case, this is very obvious here. I mean, that you have really a fusion of faith and scientific understanding from the beginning. Or you could read it as a form of process philosophy. And this is true. Teilhard did not read Whitehead until very late. Certainly his old system was formulated independently of Whitehead, yet there are very great similarities between Teilhard and Whitehead. The philosophical book that did influence Teilhard was Bergson's Creative Evolution that he read in 1908. He read Whitehead, I think, during the Second World War, after he'd written The Phenomenon of Man. But he is like Whitehead in his insistence that God is within the process, distinct from the process, but within the process, not spatially separated. but personally separated, distinguishable from the process. And he also takes as a clue to the real nature of reality, consciousness, the interior life. This, he says, has been the great fault of the scientists has been that they have taken the clue to reality, the external, tangential energy. Teilhard, like Whitehead, is convinced that reality is, we know reality best in consciousness. First of all, because here we have immediate awareness of reality. And also because consciousness grows out of the evolutionary development of the world. It is an incident in the evolutionary development of the world. And therefore it tells us something about the nature of the world. Even the most rudimentary elements in the world, or rudimentary entities in the world, like Whitehead, Teilhard, presupposes some kind of interior life, a certain within, a certain rudimentary, imperceptible consciousness, even in the most elementary form of existence. If it were not there, it could not have emerged later. Therefore, in consciousness, we have a wonder into the nature of reality itself. There is no gap, no absolute gap, no intervention between consciousness and the rest of reality. And therefore, we get our best clue to the nature of reality through consciousness. Well, first thing I'd say about Teilhard is that you can read him as a great synoptic perspectival vision, interpretation of reality, written by a man who in his own existence fuses and synthesizes science and Christian faith. Now, come a step further. I think we, and here I judge you by myself, I think we have to appreciate the new emphases in Teilhard, the new theological emphases in Teilhard. We belong to the tradition that has emphasized the historical, the moral, and judicial aspects of the incarnation and the work of Christ. This is typical of Western theology, as I indicated yesterday. Great problem of guilt and forgiveness. The problem in Eastern theology is very different from that. Problem of communion with God, union with God, problem of death, mortality. And I mentioned, I think, mentioned yesterday, if I didn't, I'll mention it again, that Calvin did not entertain the possibility that there would have been an incarnation if man had not sinned. And I would say that's a typical Reformed answer. Of course, Calvin's first answer is you ought not speculate. Secondly, he would say there's really no need for the incarnation, so far as we can see, if man had not sinned. But there is this Christian tradition that has emphasized the incarnation as a crown of creation, as a fulfillment of creation, that God would have become incarnate, the incarnation would have been appropriate even if man were not a sinner. This is an emphasis that has been lacking by and large in our Reformed tradition. And we have seen the significance of Christ, Jesus Christ, the incarnation of the Logos, Christ, the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, however you put it, primarily in terms of history and primarily in terms of the moral of sin and forgiveness. And with Teilhard, you have an entirely different emphasis. I suppose Teilhard, being a Roman Catholic, had to be concerned a little bit about forgiveness somewhere, but it doesn't come out too much. He's concerned more about development. His understanding of Christ is more integral to the total evolution of the world. The Christ is the power that is at work very much in nature from the very beginning. And here in the incarnation you have the focusing of the creative energy and power that is at work in the entire process. And therefore, the incarnation is related not simply to our historical life, but to our total life in this universe. Now, this is a different emphasis. And it comes also in his emphasis on the work of Christ. The work of Christ for Teilhard is not remedial, primarily. It's not a way of getting forgiveness. Not a way in which God somehow forgives our sins. Rather, the work of Christ is a manifestation of the constructive energies that are at work in the universe. The constructive forces and powers of the divine spirit that are working here. And therefore the cross is understood, and death upon the cross is understood not so much in Christ taking the sin of the world upon himself. But here is an illustration of the painful way in which the world evolves through suffering and God's purposes are fulfilled in suffering. Now this is very different from the emphasis that we have had in his understanding of the work of Christ. To sum up, Jesus on the cross is both the symbol and the reality of the immense labor of the centuries, which has little by little raised up the created spirit and brought back to the depths of the and brought it back to the depths of the divine media. He represents creation as upheld by God. It reascends the slope of being, sometimes clinging to other things for support, sometimes tearing itself apart from them in order to pass beyond them, and always compensating by physical suffering for the setbacks caused by its moral downfall. The cross, therefore, is not inhuman, it's superhuman. And it is a disclosure and a revelation and a giving to man of the creative forces in the universe. This is also clear when it comes to the doctrine of creation. Traditional theology, both Thomistic and Reformed theology, has distinguished very clearly between creation, God's creative act in which he brings the world into being, and God's preservation of the world in providence. For Teilhard, quite clearly, such a distinction is not possible. Creation is not an act that took place at one time, but it's a continual act. Creation is going on now. God's creative work is unfinished. He is continually creating the world. The traditional argument against that, theologically, has been that when you confuse creation and providence, you have a tendency to come up pantheistic, and with no clear distinction between the divine and the human, the creator and the creature. Teilhard understands the transcendence of God, as indicated the other day. In personal terms, God is distinct as will, as purpose, as intention from his creation. And I do not think charged pantheism is correct, but quite clearly here you have a different emphasis. And therefore you have a different emphasis on a Christian work, Christian life. The Christian life is not being good so much as it is being involved with God in the creation of the world. The good man is a man who shares with God in the creation of the world and bringing to fruition the purposes God has for mankind. He is at work in the world. You can see how this ties in with the present emphasis that you get in Harvey Cox on God as a politician. God is at work in the world, and our task is to get busy and get with it. The type of theology that's very prominent in the secular circles. But it comes out of a slightly different tradition. The problem of original sin was a severe one for Teilhard, and this is what really got him in trouble with Roman Catholic authorities. Got him in trouble in the 20s. It got him in trouble later in the 40s. They could never abide his doctrine of original sin. And for those of us who are emotionally conditioned otherwise to traditional understandings of original sin, it comes quite a shock to hear his understanding of the nature of original sin. Teilhard takes really as his foundational thought that the void, the utter nothingness out of which God created the world must be thought of in terms of infinite multiplicity, in terms of infinite possibilities. And that God's creative act can be thought of as the gradual arrangement and ordering of these multiplicities and possibilities for the achievement of his purpose in history, unification and arrangement. Therefore, as many have pointed out, Teilhard's vision of the world, in one sense, would be a cone with the large end at creation and then its unification at its fulfillment, when the multiplicities and possibilities, which are the void out of which God created the world, are organized and fulfilled. Now, evil in this world, original sin, is the difficulty or the waste that comes about inevitably in the organization of these multiplicities and so forth, these possibilities. The inevitable existence of evil in the world is a universal condition, and sin is a statistical necessity for Teilhard. This is a frequent word. He frequently speaks of sin as being a statistical necessity. Just like a statistical necessity on July the 4th, that if so many people are going to be killed on the highway. The sociologists know this. They know the statistical necessity that these people are going to be killed. Well, for Teilhard, sin is this kind of statistical necessity. And the statistical necessity is his word. When you move from this multiplicity to this unification achievement of the possibilities of human existence, it is therefore a condition of God's creation. Evil is a shadow cast across reality when God decided to create. This is somewhat similar to Paul Tillich's doctrine of the fall, where actual human existence is the fall, and original sin is a characteristic of existence as such, as existence of God created, is a statistical necessity. Now, this statistical necessity is complicated by evil which men do, and I presume here, evil which they do out of freedom. So here I say I'm a little obscure in my own understanding of Teilhard. And the evil that's done at the beginning of the human race, of human history, is more significant than evil that's done later. The consequences of this evil is much greater. Just as he would say, the consequences of evil at the in a home with a little child are much greater than the consequences of evil later. So in this sense, when evil enters into history, in the early stages of history, the consequences are much greater. And evil that enters in at a later stage in history. For Teilhard, evil is and sin is incompleteness. It is aberrant development. It is a falling away. And now particularly is pessimism about the future and failing to get with it and achieve the possibilities that God has placed in the human world and is seeking to realize. Now, hell, in the quotation I read about hell is part of the structure of the universe. As Teilhard says, you can't have development without hell because it's going to be waste. It's going to be loss. Some things cannot fit into this development. This is hell. us is a structural necessity in this kind of evolving world. Yes.
Well, then there isn't so much of a personal judgment of the divine as a mechanical process of waste.
Oh, he would never say this is a mechanical. This is highly personal. But there's waste in this personal. And of course, there's waste in all of our personal existences. Some things are irretrievably gone. The opportunities that I didn't take 30 years ago, they're gone. This is wastage in the development. And we can see this in our own lives. It's inevitably a waste. Teilhard, looking at his point of view, never attempted to be a universalist. He saw too much wastage in individual human existence. But this was never impersonal. And of course, this is one of the problems that the biologists have with Teilhard, that the development of the physical world, where consciousness is not really perceptible. Teilhard wants to posit a kind of rudimentary consciousness and personal.
How different is this from Bart's concept of the nihil, that which God excluded? I mean, that's a waste too, it seems to me, in a sense.
Well, I can't answer that because wouldn't know enough to give a full answer. But I would think it'd be very different. Of course, there's a waste everywhere, but I think in any theology, a certain measure of waste, except in some kind of absolute universalism. Yes?
Now, God is in process, too.
Well...
Is this part of his trouble with the church? As he sees God as...
I can't answer that for Teilhard. In process philosophy, generally, God's in process. Of course, with Whitehead, you have the primordial and consequent God, and the consequent God is affected and is changed. Certainly, what Hartshorn and others call classical theism would not fit Teilhard's doctrine of God. But I can't answer that, and I'm not sure it's possible to answer it. As far as I know, Teilhard doesn't deal with this problem. Teilhard is not a theologian. I mean a professional theologian. And therefore, there are a great many doctrines that he doesn't deal with. And I cannot answer that. The only thing is I'd say I cannot conceive how he could think of God without in some sense being in process. Though, of course, traditional theology would say God's not in process.
In some respects, though, if he got something from Bergson, he would come pretty close.
Well, of course, that question is, I don't know whether he got it from Bergson. And he's got also this Thomistic background. Yes?
Would you distinguish this pantheism? I mean, how pantheism? It's sort of pantheism.
Well, he doesn't intend to be a pantheist. And I don't think he's a pantheist because he says very clearly that God is distinguished from the created order. In personal categories. He does not distinguish God, or he does not express transcendence in terms of space, like God's over here and we're here, or in terms of time, that God is before time and we are in time, or in terms of causality. But he tries to express God's transcendence, God's otherness, God's freedom in personal analogies. And if he is a pantheist, he does not intend to be. And he intends to give human beings a reality of their own and a freedom of their own, a certain measure of freedom. Boy?
I believe you and Landis, and one of the few things they are said was that not in fighting, we may have trouble from our own theological perspective, but his lie was his apologetic. This is maybe important right now for us in the church, where great written theologies are not coming rolling out, but where many who might be perhaps producing this written theology are choosing with their lives to do theology, or to make where they place themselves in this converging, evolving world to make their theology with themselves.
I think this is profoundly true, and I don't know whether you are quoting Ryan O'Neill here or not, but you may be or may not be. In any case, this is Niebuhr's point that you can find in some of his last essays written in the early 60s, that the real apologetic today is the witness of your life. And there is a sense in which Teilhard's whole vision is better formulated in life. And that's a big question of how can theology best be expressed? And I think you'd have to say, ultimately and finally, theology is best expressed always in life, and more particularly in a communal life, if you want to really know the theology of people. Here is a theology that gives you a perspective in which you can participate creatively, even in this world where so much is wrong. Now, of course, one of the major criticisms made about Teilhard is that he had no realization of the nature of the demonic, that he had no understanding of the rebellion. And when he speaks about totalitarianism in 1940 as being an aberrant development in this collectivization of mankind, totalization of life, this is a strange understatement to people who were suffering and who were being put to death in Hitler's Germany at that time. You can say he underestimated it. But here is a creativity and optimism, an optimism of grace that we have been in danger of losing, and an openness to the possibilities of God in the world that holds together history and nature. And I think one of the things we have to say is that we have been in great peril of isolating history and nature in a great deal of Protestant theology. I think this is one of the ultimate weaknesses of Bardian theology, where theology was isolated in a large sense from nature. Now, Teilhard probably overdoes it. But Teilhard does not claim to say the final word. Teilhard claims that his system is open-ended, that he has simply begun, that he wants someone else to finish it out, to smooth the rough corners, to bring it to fruition. And this, I think, is a stance we have to take in all theology. The question can be added, what should be our attitude toward it? And I would say that my own attitude is that my purpose is to take my own stance in the Augustinian Reformed tradition that I would hold as open-ended. And I think it's a mistake to take your stance in a tradition only when this tradition is fixed in some historical period, which you get a certain type of fundamentalism. An open-ended tradition, and if you have an open-ended tradition, then you have a base or a stance from which to operate that has in some measure been tested by the common sense wisdom of the Christian community, and from which you can carry on conversation with all new developments. And therefore, my particular attitude toward Teilhard would be, he's a man I'd like to carry on conversation with, theologically, without becoming a disciple, who has something to contribute, to enliven, to enrich my own understanding, and a theologian to whom I ought to listen, whom I ought to engage in dialogue and in conversation, as with many others. Now, it seems to me this is a viable option, but what you get is a kind of theological fadism, where a man has no stance, but simply moves from theological fad to theological fad, as we have seen demonstrated many times in the last few years. Yes?
A little earlier you said that it was not a movement from science to faith. It seems to me that maybe that's probably part of our problem here. Generally, this is our rate of movement, and he might have moved here from faith to science, and we're butting against him rather than direction.
Well, there may have been movement. There may have been simply the two coming together and fusing as they developed, rather than as ever having been either a scientist or a theologian in isolation from each other. I would think rather that there was that in Teilhard you do not have either a movement from faith to science or science to faith, but that from boyhood, when he was preoccupied with iron, for example, to the youthful archaeological experiment, this faith and scientific endeavor fused and integrated. Therefore, you do not really have a movement. And I think this is true. In contemporary life, you do have movement. Some move from science to faith, faith to science. Well, I meant to get into Karl Rahner today, but tomorrow we shall turn to Karl Rahner, who is an entirely different kind of theologian, a far more traditional theologian in Roman Catholicism, and one who aggravates Protestants. But as the greatest of Roman Catholic theologians, and as they would say, the greatest theologian of modern times, he has, with which I would certainly not agree, but which Roman Catholics say and some Protestants say. A man with whom we ought to be acquainted.